Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping the future. Live or in demand, we bring you the stories that keep you informed and ahead. South Africa has sufficient planned imports and there's no need to panic buy petrol or diesel. We speak to the CEO of the Fuels Industry Association of South Africa about this. We also take a look at the country's economic rebound hanging on urgent reform. That's according to the Bureau for Economic Research. We also speak to FNB about South Africans turning more and more to solar as an energy source. We end off the show with looking at how Cape Town is unlocking value in organic waste. And Dirk de Wet is operations manager at Oracle. He'll help us understand. In a statement published on the 20th of March 2026, the Department of Mineral and Petroleum Resources said, and I read, "Government and industry reiterates assurances on fuel supply and urges the public not to panic buy. The Department of Mineral and Petroleum Resources has noted with concern the circulation of statements and messages by certain organizations and individuals encouraging members of the public to rush to filling stations due to a perceived fuel shortage and anticipated fuel price increase." Close quote. Now, a recent report by the Daily Investor notes that many fuel stations across South Africa have run out of diesel, and in sporadic cases, petrol, prompting stakeholders to call for action. Abafani Chifularo is the CEO of Fuels Industry Association of South Africa and joins us for more. Thank you very much, sir, for your time this afternoon. I quote that statement from the 20th of March from the DMPR because there's nothing new I see here on their website, because I'm on their website as well in terms of the state of play. In the absence of that, as a stakeholder, what is the current state of play?
Yeah, so currently we're still seeing stable supply of products. I think the statement by the DMPR is still valid. So as we look at the month of April, we still see that we are fine. We are managing the situation. We've got sufficient planned imports that are coming into the country. With the month of May and June still, being confirmed. And what we have seen, though, is that, there is some panic buying, which is putting a strain into service stations because of the time it takes to replenish stocks at individual service stations. But overall, there is sufficient product in the country.
Okay. You say we have sufficient planned imports. And so help us understand in terms of where South Africa gets its oil from. We are a net importer of oil, no?
Correct. So if we look at the feedstock in the form of crude oil, largely we are dependent on the continent. The biggest supply is Nigeria, and then we'll be followed by countries like Ghana, like Angola. Then there's a little bit that comes from, I think it's less than, 20% of our crude oil requirement. It comes from Saudi Arabia or Middle East. That is as far as, crude oil is concerned. But when it comes to products, we import products from the U.S., we import products from UAE, India, and many other countries. So the imports of finished product, it's over 50% of our own requirements. The balance of what we use in the country is manufactured by our three refineries. And that's really the current situation. Right now, the current refineries, the two are operational. One is on a planned maintenance, but there are planned imports to cater for the demand for that refinery. But the refinery itself is going to be coming back towards the end of April.
Okay. So please do correct me if I'm wrong, but what I'm hearing essentially is that the closure of the Strait of Hormuz has not disproportionately impacted South Africa because we get most of our oil right here on the continent.
As far as crude oil, that's correct. The bulk of our crude oil, it comes from the continent. But as far as finished products are concerned, there is some suppliers who experience disruption, especially those who have been getting their product from Middle East places like Oman and so forth.
Okay. Please explain to us between the diesel price and the petrol price, where are the prices set?
So The petrol price is set by the government through the Minister of Mineral and Petroleum Resources. So essentially, he fixed the price at the retail level, and you can't discount or sell above that price. The price is changed once per month. So we are due for another announcement for the month of April this week. But as far as diesel is concerned, the department does not regulate the price of diesel, even at wholesale and also retail. So individual station owners, they set their own prices. They decide when to change their prices.
Given that we have three refineries, you said that one is undergoing maintenance, two are operational. What is our refining capacity? Because the conversation right now is that perhaps the continent needs to take a closer look at refining its own oil and bolstering that. But would you say that we are at comfortable levels? Why do we import? Or why are we net importers of crude oil?
We are net importers of crude oil because the country does not have its own crude oil. So until such point in time where we discover our own crude oil, the whole situation will change. But for now, we are dependent on the imported crude oil. You asked the question of refining capacity. Mm. So back in 2019, we had six refineries, and two have pretty much disappeared. One converted into import terminal, the other one is pretty much disappeared due to flood. It was flooded. And the other one, they have paused operations. So we've lost almost 50% of our refining capacity, which is equate to 350,000 barrels per day. But as long as you have got crude oil refinery and you don't have crude oil in South Africa, you're always going to be reliant on imported crude oil. So the question is does it serve the country better to have more refining capacity vis-a-vis building a more storage facility to store finished products? Crude oil refinery, it works or a refinery, it's a 24/7 operations. Mm-hmm. It works very different from planning perspective compared to just an import of finished products. With crude oil, you get to benefit quite a lot because there are so many byproducts of refining products, which are required by many downstream industries. Also, the refinery itself, the local economy benefits a lot from a refinery. But the issue of global, disruptions or geopolitics, what we are experiencing now, mm-hmm. whether you are on a crude oil refinery that is dependent on a imported crude oil, or you are just importing product, you are exposed to all those geopolitical tensions. You can't avoid that.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe we can reiterate the message to South Africans. There is nothing to fear, and there's no reason to panic buy at this moment, at least.
Indeed. We continue to see a national fuel supply system that's stable, with adequate availability of all major petroleum products across the country. We are just experiencing challenge with panic buying, mm-hmm. where the demand at the service station is quite elevated, but otherwise there is sufficient fuel available. So a service station might drive for a couple of hours, but it will be replenished in time.
Thank you so much, sir, for helping us understand that. Abafani Chifularo is the CEO of the Fuels Industry Association of South Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The South African economy is set to grow by 1.6% this year, but factors beyond its control are threatening to reverse some hard-won gains, especially those noted in the fourth quarter of 2025. According to the Bureau for Economic Research at Stellenbosch University, the country faces a set of crucial policy choices that can move the needle in the right or wrong direction. In a report titled Pick a Bird, Any Bird, Scenarios for the South African Economy 2026 to 2030, the BER has modeled three scenarios using a similar core econometric model as the National Treasury and the South African Reserve Bank. Roy Haverman is a senior economist at BER. He joins us now for more. Roy, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. Maybe let's start briefly with how the report was put together.
Yeah, good afternoon, and thank you very much for having me. The idea really is to try and how do we articulate the different futures that we can have as a country, depending on what we do. And we decided to pick birds. There's also been a very similar process run by the Ndumeleli Scenarios Project. And they looked also at different birds. We borrowed one of their birds, the hardy-dar, because I think the hardy-dar is really the bird that we don't want to be. It's a big bird that just bounces around. It squawks a lot. It talks but doesn't do anything. And that's kind of how we think of the economy at the moment.
All right, so you've explained the hardy-dar. The marabou?
The marabou is called the undertaker bird. It famously features in the Five Ugly Birds book if you have children. It's a very ugly, big, tall bird. It scavengers quite a lot, and it's a lot like the years of state capture. Under that scenario, we see the economy declining, per capita GDP going even worse, and basically it's not a great outlook.
So we've covered two birds, the hardy-dar, marabou, and then you've got the fish eagle, because your key finding is that South Africa can create an additional 2.4 million jobs by 2030 relative to 2025. But as we have only a narrow window of opportunity in which to act, we need to focus sharply on a single simple vision for the economy. Expand on the fish eagle vision for us.
So the fish eagle, as we all know, is this amazing bird with like incredible sight, and it can swim, and it is a fish catcher, and I think it really epitomizes the best of South Africa. We think that if you do the right things, then you can quite quickly become a fish eagle as an economy. We haven't set incredibly ambitious targets, so we say that we think 3% growth is possible. We think 3% inflation is possible, and we think a 3% fiscal deficit is possible. So we call this our 3x3x3 scenario. And many of the things are actually being done at the moment. So the president has obviously initiated this program of work called Operation Vulindlela. Mm-hmm. And one of the big things we've seen out of Operation Vulindlela has been the end of load shedding, which I think all agree has been very good for economic growth. But there are other things that Operation Vulindlela is doing, for example, getting our ports to work and getting our railway lines to work and improving municipalities. But the most interesting thing is we do regular business confidence surveys and consumer confidence surveys. And there was a Social Research Foundation survey about what do South Africans worry about. And interesting enough, all of our surveys and their survey came to the same conclusion, which is that the average South African and the average South African business really worries about crime and corruption. Mm-hmm. And so we've actually said maybe that should be our number one thing to add to what's already being done. And implementing the Zondo Commission inquiry recommendations, Langer Commission's going on, obviously implementing everything that comes out of that, making the National Prosecuting Authority financially and operationally independent, and making sure they have the right budget and can do the right things, and then working on the illicit economy. Those big reforms will really help growth.
Mm. Because with all of these scenarios, you've got key metrics on which you judge them, right? So you've spoken about some of the core drivers, spoken about GDP growth. We've touched on the new jobs that will be added. And for the fish eagle scenario, that's 2.4 million by 2030. Poverty outcomes is one of the metrics. And with the fish eagle scenario, poverty falls materially. Interestingly, this report covers right up until 2030. And that's when we also need to have realized our national development goals. What do you say to people's lived realities, rather, that we hear you and we encourage this, because we do want the same thing, poverty to be reduced drastically in the country, people to have more confidence in this country so investments can flow. But you look at what the Auditor General released last week in terms of that report of the Auditor General's office. It makes for grim reading. There are places where load shedding is still a reality in South Africa. You take a look at people's real cost of living, it's quite tight. And so what do you say to South Africans who are looking at this and are a little bit skeptical to say, shoo, I'm not so sure?
Yes, well, we're actually also a little bit skeptical in our baseline. So what we think is the current scenario is actually the hardy-dar, which is this, you know, is not a great outcome. And that's where poverty is stagnating. And we only add 1 million new jobs in the next few years, which is really not enough to make a meaningful difference on the unemployment rate. Because, you know, the number of people coming into jobs is rising quite quickly. And so I think that the lived reality of the average person is probably somewhere at the moment between the Haridaw and the marabou stork. It's really not a great life. And completely agree with you about, you know, rising cost of living. On the load shedding issue, what we've seen, and we've done a lot of business surveys, is that businesses and households, but particularly businesses because it's very important to them, are experiencing electricity problems because the distribution network is not working. So for them, like you say, it is actually basically load shedding. Many South Africans are not getting a stable supply of electricity. And I think that just highlights that we need to double down on the reform program and make sure that we get electricity to everybody, that we make sure that our exporters can get goods out so that we can increase the number of jobs in export-facing industries and that we can get people working.
Fair enough. May I say this? I don't know much about the marabou bird as a bird, right? But the Haridaw, I tell you, I love the Haridaw. And so I just really need to say or ask, why the Haridaw? Why, I guess, the choice of birds, or why the use of birds to sort of illustrate your point, which is quite clever.
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of people said they love the Haridaw. The Haridaw often wakes me up in the morning, so maybe I'm not a great fan of the Haridaw.
You see?
Haridaw also steals the dog food from the dogs. There used to have a big fight, the Haridaw and the dogs. But it is this, I mean, it's kind of who we are as a country. We're kind of happy with bumbling around and sort of, you know, squawking, and, you know, maybe there's more. We can be a fish eagle.
You're right. You're absolutely right. I don't dispute that. I was just curious. Thank you so much, Roy. We really appreciate your time. Roy Haverman is Senior Economist at the Bureau for Economic Research.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Okay, let's take a look at this now. Interest in solar installations in the country is mounting as households and businesses look to manage escalating power bills and improve long-term energy resilience. That's according to First National Bank. We speak now to Kagiso Masela, Manager of Retail Sustainability and ESG Solutions at FNB. Kagiso, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. Maybe we can take a look for just greater context, because we're saying that this demand is mounting, right? What did we see the demand line during peak season, where load shedding was at its worst, compared to what we're seeing now that we are told that the grid is stabilizing?
100%. Thanks for having me. I think maybe one can just take it at a point where we look at the electricity tariffs. They are the ones that are kind of guiding and shaping the interest in solar specifically. And maybe one can use this as a starting point, you know, to say electricity tariffs are definitely back on spotlight again, and understandably so. Even though load shedding has eased lately, South Africans are now dealing with another reality, which is the cost of electricity that keeps on climbing, and climbing faster than inflation, and just ahead of the increases now in April and possibly now in July again. Households and businesses are facing, you know, increases of around 9% on top of what has already been a tough 2-year period. And in fact, you know, prices have risen almost by roughly 18% over the past 2 years already, which fundamentally changes how people experience energy in their day-to-day lives. Mm-hmm. And for households this means electricity is taking up a bigger share of the monthly income.
Yeah.
It competes directly with food, transport, school fees, bond repayments. And that's for small and medium-sized businesses. Electricity is a core operating cost.
Yeah.
So every percentage increase puts pressure on the margins, cash flow and growth decisions. So definitely from an FNB perspective, we are seeing a shift. Energy challenges are no longer just about keeping the lights on. You know, they're about affordability, predictability, and certainly financial resilience. And this is definitely then influencing the consumer behavior, because historically, a lot of people tend to solar because of load shedding. It was a reactive response. And what we are seeing now is different. The rising tariffs are pushing households and businesses to look at alternative solutions like solar and storage, purely as a financial decision, not an emergency one.
Right. This is quite interesting because according to you, more so when we speak of businesses as well as the household level, you note that with strong growth in rentals, you noted rather a strong growth in rental solutions and loan funded purchases, but today cash purchases dominate overall spend while loans play a supporting role. What does this tell us about the consumer, about the business?
Sure. I think one can take it back to initially, you know, there was an emergency driven installation, you know, where most of our consumers during load shedding, they tend more to solar, and during that period specifically, the demand for solar surged, and we saw that there was a growth also in rental solution solar. So basically, where one can rent solar solution, and I think this really comes as we've seen a cyclical performance of rental solar going up and down since load shedding, but now because of the tariffs also we see a lot of that taking place now, and I think it's more also on affordability. You know, solar doesn't necessarily come affordable, so most of the time then consumers lean more to a rental solar option, but also to test it out, because most of us and consumers are not necessarily familiar with the technology. So for one, to not just over invest, most consumers then find it easier to just test it out through a rental option, and then make a decision as to, is this something that I'd like to fully invest in? Yeah, but definitely that change we've seen, that rental solar is still quite solid in the market. But loans are also playing a supporting role, because most consumers are still purchasing solar that they link into their home loans.
Okay. Then we talk about trust in suppliers. How important is that, or how much of a concern is that for both businesses and households?
Trust in suppliers. Firstly, I think it's beyond affordability itself. You know, we always say, you know, affordability is often the first barrier people think about when it comes to installing solar. But in our experience, trust is just as bigger, if not bigger. The solar market expanded very quickly, I think one can recall, during the peak of load shedding. And customers now are seen as more cautious. They worry about poor quality installations. They worry about unqualified installers, incorrect system sizing, and lack of after-sales support. And I mean, what we've also seen that there's also a knowledge gap in the market, where many households don't fully understand their own energy usage, which makes it difficult to choose the right solution without that insight, even a well-intentioned renewable investment can underperform. So therefore, we've informed, you know, at F&B we've stressed that, you know, reliability is at the core of what we're doing. So we offer a vetting as a value add to when consumers are taking solar financing with us, where we vet the suppliers that the consumers are bringing to the bank, where we look at minimum things like the CIPC documents, just to make sure that the directors of the company are not involved in any fraudulent activity. We look at their business bank accounts to make sure that there's no money laundering linked to those accounts. We look at the minimum experience and qualifications they have in the solar industry, in solar installation. And ultimately, we look at the electricians that the solar supplier is using, needing to make sure that they are registered with the Department of Labor to ensure that we are, the consumer is going to use an electrician that's legit and that will be able to sign off their COC. So definitely that speaks to that trust piece also at a point of installation. And that's the offering that we offer our consumers as support during this journey.
That's a comforting thought, that you comb through your suppliers. Thank you so much, Kagiso, for your time this afternoon. Kagiso Masela is the Manager of Retail Sustainability and ESG Solutions at FNB.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
So by 2030, South Africa needs to have realized its national development plans, yet concerns are mounting about our ability to successfully meet our waste management goals. According to the National Waste Management Plan, in 4 years, the country should have zero waste in landfills, cleaner communities, well-managed and financially stable waste services, and a culture of zero tolerance of pollution, litter, and illegal dumping, among others. Of all the waste categories now, organic waste contributes to more than 50% of the total of general waste disposed in the country and has a comparative recycling rate of 49%. Research indicates that almost one-third of all organic waste consists of food waste. We speak more on this with Dirk De Wet, Operations Manager at Oracle. Dirk, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. And we speak about this as we celebrating today International Zero Waste Day, being on the 30th of March. Perhaps let's start by looking at this, right? How would you characterize the waste landscape in South Africa?
Thank you, Dudu. I think South Africa is very much in the developing market stratosphere when it comes to the waste management system. And government is really looking at us as the private sector to lead the fight. I would characterize the waste as two separate waste generators. One is the commercial and industrial waste generators, and the other is the consumer-driven market. So the post-consumer and pre-consumer. Pre-consumer waste is waste that's in the industrial market. There, the private sector is highly relevant. Legislation is starting to support us driving waste diversion from landfill. And really, that is positive that the government is driving. It's not happening fast enough, but I believe it's heading in the right direction. But the real problem the government faces is on post-consumer waste. This is residential waste, where you have highly contaminated waste, very little waste separation at source, and which makes it very difficult for us as the private sector and government to separate waste downstream.
Sure. Now, organic waste has been identified as a stream that should be prioritized for waste prevention and diversion from landfill. How are you responding to this call, more so in the Western Cape?
So in the Western Cape, we have partnered with Cape Town Biogas. Cape Town Biogas is a biodigester. We take in our specialty is pre-consumer waste, so commercial and industrial waste. We manage waste on behalf of our large waste generators, international as well as local manufacturers. The waste comes to our facility. We depackage the waste if it's packaged. If it's not packaged, so meaning that these are your potato peels that you're getting when the guys are processing potatoes, as an example, that goes directly into the biodigester. If it's packaged, we depackage it using our equipment. All of that goes into the biogas plant, which then gets used to generate both green energy as well as an alternative CO2 gas that gets back plowed back into industry. And really, I think that's where we're driving the change, saying there are alternatives available. Legislation is supporting it. Let's make sure all our customers are aware of the impending legislation changes and there is alternatives.
Yeah, let's talk about that, or rather let's expand on that, because by 2027, a 100% organic waste landfill ban embedded directly into waste management licenses takes effect. Who is most impacted by this, and how should they prepare to be on the right side of the law, as you say?
Look, I think the large waste generators are mostly impacted. Retail chains, food manufacturers, hospitality groups, agricultural processors. Those are the guys that really need to be aware of it. How they should prepare, I think understanding your waste is very important. Getting guys like us to look at source separation of waste so that the waste management down the line, so that we can actually reuse the waste as an alternative resource. Partnering with the right companies, obviously you want to partner with people who aren't necessarily landfill driven. You want to partner with companies that shows that they don't want to support landfill, and that will in effect support your goals. And I think the guys need to be aware that there will be cost shifts that need to happen. You know, the reality is that landfill is probably one of the cheapest solutions out there in terms of waste disposal. And until that changes, you are going to pay more for a better solution, which is what life is like, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the last one is really contractual and license alignment. You know, making sure that your contracts that's in place supports local legislation and that you're not getting caught by government that you're breaking the law. So it is very, very important for the large waste generators to be well aware and to select the right partners.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment is encouraging a move towards a more circular economy. What is your take on this?
Oh, now you're talking my language. turning waste into a resource is our motto, and we've been doing it for two decades now. And what we have found is the most sustainable way of managing waste is when you can add value to waste, so you can make it a valuable commodity. And pure logic, when it comes to the circular economy, needs to be applied here. Instead of spending huge amounts of money trying to extract natural resources, we've got waste which can be reused as an alternative to natural resources. By commoditizing waste, you're giving it a value. If you give it a value, industries will follow. So really, the circular economy, I can't see any other way for South Africa to overcome its waste challenges unless it grabs the circular economy model and supports it quite heavily with legislation.
Thank you so much, Dirk, for your time this afternoon. Dirk De Wet is Operations Manager at Oracle. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, bye-bye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.